Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, back at the dawn of time, or when I was in college, whichever was more recent, I'm not sure, about the same time, but somewhere in my checkered past, I ended up with a degree in English literature, along with a chemistry degree. So that may explain the my continuing identity crisis in life, I suppose. But anyway, but you know, way back then when I was young and idealistic and so on, I wrote some poems and a couple of short stories, and I actually had one short story published in a prestigious review, which gave me stars in my eyes for a while. But I wrote a couple of movie scripts a little later on. They were B-movie scripts, and one of them actually got made into a movie in Canada. Anyway, with all that, I've been fascinated by language pretty much all my life, and you know, etymology, the roots of words, the sources and derivations of words, how they evolve in terms of their usage, and you know, the slang, where slang comes from, some of that's pretty fascinating, and the connections between words in different languages, and how, you know, English is kind of a hodgepodge, compendium of words from all different languages. And I used to be pretty good at puns. They kind of sprang sort of unbidden from my fevered brain back then. Not so much anymore, but they used to a lot. Anyway, we've had a lot of writers on the show, you know, novelists and a couple of filmmakers and people who are literary by nature, but we've never done a show on language as such, right? So I'm going to take a chance today and do one on linguistics, which is the scientific study of language. My guest today is Professor Dallin Oakes, who is an associate professor of linguistics, and he's asked me to say English linguistics as opposed to other languages, at Brigham Young University in Utah. Welcome, Dallin.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on. So I'm going to start off by asking, what does a linguist do?
Boy, that's a really broad question.
You mean there's not a 25-word or less answer to that question?
Well, I'll try to make it quick here.
Okay.
It's a little bit like asking, what does a scientist do? There are lots of subfields within linguistics. Some people study various languages, looking, you know, at some of the less studied languages, what some of us might call exotic languages. Mm-hmm. Others look at language interfaces with things like technology, computers, computer translation, natural language processing. Others look at the best ways to learn or to teach languages. There are just a variety of things that linguists study.
Well, what do you do? I mean, within all those different branches of linguistics, what's your area of expertise?
Most of my research falls in the structure of the language, and most specifically, I've done a lot of studying in ambiguity.
In ambiguity. Okay, so in the way that language can be ambiguous.
Exactly.
Well, your work is, I've read a little bit about it, so it's the structural ambiguity of English. I kind of like that idea and the approach you take to looking at language because it's a somewhat scientific approach, you know, maybe more so than other forms of linguistics are, but a scientific organized approach to describing how to, in effect, do tricks with the language systematically. And you've devised some formulas for dealing with words in the language that prospectively people in advertising or comedians or people who write greeting cards, and there was people who are wordsmiths for a living, particularly in the humorous side of words, can use. So we're going to get into that in this show, and that's kind of the heart of what we're going to talk about here in American Variety. So why don't you tell us about your specific work and what you found out?
Well, I've really done a lot of investigating into the kind of features and characteristics of the language that lend themselves well to structural ambiguity. And structural ambiguity is where the structure is ambiguous, not just the word meanings. So sometimes they're the ones that really make us stop and think for a little more time than if it just had a word ambiguity. A lot of some of the best and long-lasting jokes and advertisements involve structural ambiguities. And, you know, it's funny, the language, surprisingly enough, has some identifiable features that can really be exploited by somebody who takes the time to study and learn what those features are.
So, well, why don't we take some examples of what structural ambiguity is? You're talking about ambiguous grammar in the way a sentence is put together. I mean, give us some examples.
Yeah. Well, first I'll contrast this with a lexical ambiguity, which is just where a word might have a different meaning, but it doesn't change the way we interpret the overall structure of it. If I said he saw the bat, are we talking about the creature that flies? Or are we talking about the thing that you use on a baseball team? That's a lexical ambiguity, and it's called lexical because it's just a word meaning ambiguity. But if I had, on the other hand, something like the ad that Glad Garbage Bags has used for many years, don't get mad, get glad, where you have to interpret, is glad an adjective? Is he telling me to be happy, or is this something I purchase, in which case it's a noun that's serving like a direct object? And I don't expect everybody to pay a lot of attention to all the terminology I'm using here. I realize that's kind of a side issue for most listeners probably. But you can see the difference in the fact that there is a structure that's different here when I say get glad. And, you know, in the old diagramming that a lot of us had to do in school, if we had to diagram that the two meanings, they'd be diagrammed differently. Whereas with he saw the bat, the diagram would be the same.
Okay, so like most puns, I think, are what you're calling lexical ambiguity, where the word can be taken one of two ways, but it, the way the sentence is formed is the same, and the meaning would be the same, except that the word has two different meanings. So you kind of take A or B in terms of your interpretation of it, right? Is that?
Yeah, I think certainly many of the puns are that way, and sometimes the ones that we groan at are the ones where the person's attempting to do a structural ambiguity, and they just can't make the grammar work. It's kind of ill-formed. It's where you can only see it because you know the person's trying to be funny and they're trying to do a pun and it doesn't quite work. And that's usually a structural ambiguity that they couldn't pull off because the grammar or the structure was not working together for both meanings.
Well, I remember the idea from college reading somewhere that puns are the lowest form of humor. And I remember thinking, what? I think sometimes they're pretty funny. Maybe it's just me, but I mean, you know, for example, last weekend I was at a Harry Connick Jr. Concert, and so he was bantering with people in the audience, you know, as they'll do, and so he picked on a guy who was in the front row and said, "Wow, how did you get such good tickets?" And I guess he couldn't hear the man, but he must have said to him, "I have lots of patience." And so then Harry Connick Jr. said, "Lots of patience? You must be a doctor." And then he said, "Oh, you mean that kind of patience." So that would be, you know, it's a groaner. You know, it's a bad pun, but that would be a lexical ambiguity, right?
It is lexical and structural. And sometimes something can be both. If it has a word meaning that there's a difference in the word meaning, but it also changes the structural meaning. In this case, and some people might still call this a lexical as well, even some linguists, they might disagree with me. But here, patience could be what's called a non-count noun, or it could be a plural. And this works because the person has put it in the object position rather than the subject position. Again, I don't need to get into the details, but I think that's both lexical and structural.
Okay.
In that case. And one of the points I want to make is that people can actually make the structural ones work if they understand some of the tricks behind them, the way the language is set up.
Well, give me an example.
Well, one of the examples I have here is a joke that I actually found in a joke collection, and it doesn't work structurally. It's ill-formed.
Okay.
But here's the joke. It says, "Why cannot a deaf man be legally convicted? Because it is unlawful to condemn a man without a hearing." Well, the problem there is the sensory perception of hearing that we have, we would not put an article in front of it. We would just say without hearing.
Yeah.
But a court proceeding, we have to say a hearing.
Right.
And that's because they belong to two different noun classes here. But one of the features I've identified is a determiner called no. And if you use no, you can use it in front of both types of noun classes, so I could have said, because it is unlawful to condemn a man with no hearing.
Okay, yeah.
Now there, the pun that didn't work before structurally does now, and that's a sort of strategy or formula that could be used repeatedly for all those situations where you have, or many of those situations where you have nouns from these two different classes, count and non-count is what we're dealing with here. Or as people in the old grammar school said, maybe mass nouns versus regular nouns.
Okay, maybe a similar example from the material that you sent me before the show was, when is a dog overweight? And so the joke answer would be, when it is a husky. But it's a kind of a stretch, because really you wouldn't say if he's fat, you wouldn't say he's a husky. It's obviously you're talking about the breed of dog in that case. And the flip side of it should be when it is husky, but you can't have it both ways. So you have another device for inserting a word or making that work both ways, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a device there, and it's the expression a little. And that bridges an incompatibility between an adjective and a noun. And so it can be repeated all kinds of things. You know, if I say there was an advertisement where they had a show for Tim Allen that was coming out. It was called Jungle to Jungle. And it said something like this: on March 7th, Tim Allen. Oh, I should say this show involved him adopting a boy from the jungle. And they wanted to play off the word savage. But savage as a noun has to have a word like in front of it. And savage as an adjective doesn't. But they said on March 7th, Tim Allen gets a little savage. Now it works, because a little bridges that incompatibility between nouns and adjectives. So, you know, it's not the highest humor there, but it's still a pretty good billboard. It'll grab people's attention and make them think for a minute, and that's what advertisers, I think, want to do.
So the other joke would be, when is a dog overweight? When it is a little husky, is the idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
gotcha.
That's the strategy to solve that ill-formed riddle about the dog is to use a little.
So that's something you could use a lot to connect those two types of, you know, one being an adjective, one being a noun. You just insert a little.
It works for most noun-adjective words, and there are lots of those in the language, like novel and uniform and savage and negative and all kinds of words.
So just thinking of some of the famous jokes, or maybe infamous or maybe long-forgotten jokes from the past, like Henny Youngman, who was a comedian, I don't know, the 50s and 60s, one of his, you know, classic lines was, "Take my wife, please." So what kind of ambiguity is that? Is that strictly lexical?
That's mostly lexical. I take a broader view of structural ambiguity than many linguists, so sometimes I'll label things as a structural ambiguity that even other linguists would not. That's mostly lexical. I could argue that that's structural for some other reasons I probably won't get into, but yeah.
Okay.
It's a great line from Henny Youngman.
And so you had in some material you sent me something from a letter of recommendation for someone applying for a job. I cannot recommend him too highly.
Yeah.
So that's ambiguous. That's structural there, because you, like you said, it's how you diagram the sentence. Not that our listeners want to remember back to ninth grade when they learned how to diagram a sentence.
No, no. I'm not trying to set up a grammar camp here, but on this radio show.
But it can be taken as, I can't recommend him highly enough, or I cannot recommend him very highly. It can be taken either way, and they're both opposite, right? So.
Yeah. And that comes from a series, you know, you'll find these things that float around the internet because people find them funny. Some of the other statements in that letter of recommendation, you know, a situation where a person's been forced to write a letter they really don't want to write. They say, you'll be lucky if you can get him to work for you. And that's a lexical ambiguity there. But and my point is not to claim that the structural are always better than the lexical. You have some very clever lexical ambiguities, too. But they're working together. You can get some great combinations.
Okay, so there must be, since you're a scientist, you must have broken this down. There must be different types of structural ambiguity. Why don't you itemize some of those, assuming there are?
Okay, there are lots and lots of variations, but there are three major ones that I think most of us will recognize as having heard. The first type is where you have a part of speech, where you remember the parts of speech, the nouns, the verbs, the adjectives.
Mm-hmm.
So some of us have heard the old joke, you know, what has four wheels and flies, and the answer is a garbage truck, and we stop and go, wait a minute, flies. I was thinking the verb flies in the air, and now you're talking insect flies, and that's a noun. So that's taking us back and forth between parts of speech. Another type is the grammatical function. That's like, you know, is this a subject, or is this a direct object, or is this an indirect object? And, Court, if you don't mind, I'll give an old thing from a George Burns and Gracie Allen show. I think it was a funny line they used, but it illustrates the grammatical function well.
Okay, can't be much older than the what has four wheels and flies joke. So go ahead, that's fine.
Well,
it's new to most of our listeners.
There's a scene where George Burns walks into the room and he sees Gracie with some beautiful flowers, and he says, "Gracie, those are beautiful flowers. Where do they come from?" And she says, "Don't you remember, George? You said that if I went to visit Clara Bagley in the hospital, I should be sure to take her flowers. So when she wasn't looking, I did." Now here, the ambiguity is, of course, between her as part of a direct object, take her flowers.
Yeah.
But the other interpretation is where her is an indirect object, where I'm taking flowers to her. I'm taking her some flowers. And, you know, it's, I think, been a popular enough joke that even now people still pass that one around the internet, I think. So, you know, that's a grammatical function ambiguity. And then we have modifier ambiguities, like the famous Groucho Marx line. By modifier, we mean things that describe something else. And sometimes it's not clear what the modifier matches up with. What's the descriptive word or phrase supposed to attach to? And the example from this of Groucho Marx's line is, he says, "I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got into my pajamas, I'll never know." And here, you know, the prepositional phrase "in my pajamas," we can't tell. Is that getting hooked up with the verb "shot," or is it describing the elephant? And so the modifier is either describing a verb or a noun. And then there are all kinds of variations under these three major groups. They take all the variations you could anticipate, and then some.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're on with Professor Dallin Oakes from Brigham Young University in Utah. He's a linguistics professor, and we're talking about structural ambiguity. He's actually written a book called Structural Ambiguity in English, an Applied Grammatical Inventory, and it's, you know, a scholarly academic work, but we're talking about the, you know, the 30,000-foot level of it here, the more secular versions of it, where basically he has identified some ways in which English can be used in an ambiguous way, and he's identified the kind of patterns of that that you can then, once you understand them, you can use it to generate humorous statements or slogans or, you know, funny sayings or greeting cards or things that can be used in a commercial way as well as just by comedians in humor. I don't suppose that's a commercial either, is it? But, well, let me give you some examples, Dallin, and ask you to tell us whether they are, you just described three kinds of structural ambiguity, one based on the parts of speech, another based on grammatical function within a sentence, and the third one based on whether it's a modifier or not, or what the phrase modifies. So it's all kind of grammatical sounding, but I think it'll be a little clearer if we have some examples. You described a minute ago something that Groucho Marx said, and I remember something else funny that he said one time, "Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read." So,
yeah.
So what is that? Which type is that?
I consider that structural.
Yeah, but within that, what type? Is it grammatical function? I mean, outside of a dog.
That one, let's see, outside of a dog.
Because the first phrase, outside of a dog, modifies book in the one case, and then in the other,
yeah.
It's...
Yeah, this is a modification, structural ambiguity, and like I said, there's a whole host of those. Some dealing with pre-modifiers, some with post-modifiers, some with modifiers where we can't tell, is it modifying a verb in here or is it modifying the whole phrase? You know, one of the famous lines from, I think, the movie Airplane, where you had Leslie Nielsen, somebody said something to him like, "Surely you don't mean to go in
oh,
there."
Yeah.
It was something like that, and he said, "I do, and don't call me Shirley."
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's a modifier type of ambiguity, and not a lot different from the outside of a dog. It's the Groucho Marx line you just gave. Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read.
You know, one of the things that I think everybody notices around the country where puns and plays on words are most prevalent, oddly enough, is on church marquees. And sometimes they're darn clever, and sometimes they're just complete groaners, you know.
Yeah. But,
and I assume they get these all from a website or some book or something. But it's very common. In fact, you hardly ever see a church marquee that doesn't have some sort of pun on it or whatever. So I'll just give you a couple that I've remembered and see what category of structural ambiguity if they are or if they're lexical ambiguity. It's like one is 7 days without prayer makes 1 week, and it's spelled W-E-A-K.
Yeah, that's a structural ambiguity that actually plays off the possibilities of the verb make. One thing that people don't realize is the verbs don't just have different meanings. Mm-hmm. They actually have different numbers of slots to them. So it's kind of like the old Tinker Toys that I grew up with, where you have some wood blocks and some of them have a capability. They have, you know, four holes or five holes or two holes, and you would build these structures and you would know exactly what you needed to put together to get the structures. Well, make is a verb that's enormously flexible, not just because of its meanings, but because it introduces different types of structures that you can build. And you'll find a lot of these that use make, and get is another one, and find is another one. But, yeah, that's a great example, and it's one that I actually, I think, have in my book as well.
All right, so in that case, makes 1 week either means comprises a week or causes one to be weak, you know, so it's, I guess what you're saying is that it's a flexible verb. How about the best vitamin for a Christian is B1, B, capital B, you know, vitamin B1 on the one hand, or to be one. All right,
yeah.
So what type is that?
That's also, let's see, that's also another one of the ones that I would say is a grammatical function.
Okay.
And it depends on... Well, you've got a couple things going on there, but what's following the is? Is it a subject complement, or is it a subject complement that's comprised of a sort of clause, an embedded clause? There's you know, more going on there than I should talk about right now, but yeah.
Okay. You're not saying that it depends on the definition of what is. Is you?
No.
So, all right.
But some of it does depend on what we think is following is.
Okay, how about this last one, and then I'll leave the church groaners. So, to belittle is to be little. What type is that?
Yeah.
I mean, you get the pun, right?
To belittle
is to be little.
Well, that, among other things, relies on a word division ambiguity, and I address that in my book as well, which the word division ambiguities can create some really interesting word plays. There was the case even down in Florida of the woman who was part of a promotion to sell things with a restaurant, and she won the contest and was told that she'd be given a Toyota, and went out into the parking lot. They blindfolded her to give her Toyota and took off the blindfold and handed her a Yoda doll, you know, like from Star Wars, and that was a toy Yoda. Notice there's a word division ambiguity there, among other things. There's some also pronunciation factors involved, but a word division between the car Toyota and a toy Yoda, and you also have that in that church sign you mentioned, where to be little versus to be little. And when we play with these word division boundaries, we get additional possibilities for structural ambiguity.
I remember that one. I think she was a Hooters waitress. It was three or four years back. Yeah, she was.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. In fact, yeah, you're right on that.
She didn't think it was a hoot at all. In fact, she sued him.
No, she... I saw a photo from that news story. It was an AP, you know, wire story, and the photo, at least that I saw in the paper, she was not happy. she was posing next to her Yoda doll.
Yeah, so I think the manager of the store thought this would be a great, you know, a lot of fun, and you know, it'd be a big laugh for everybody. But it was for everybody but her. the lawyer she hired, I think, had a great laugh out of it too. Finally.
Yeah, it was not a wise business decision, I'd have to say.
Yeah. So a lot of things then also come down to how you pronounce them, too, and those can be different in writing versus reading. Like, way back in the same period when I was, you know, right out of college, I used to think of funny sayings, and so I started producing T-shirts, and I thought I'd have a line of T-shirts that I could sell that were funny, and this thing flopped miserably, but some of the T-shirts were pretty sublime, actually. So at least I thought. So one was it had a picture on the front of a zipper with an ant running along the zipper, and then the slogan or the line was "Experience Seams." So it's S-E-A-M-S was the spelling. And I guess that was one of these 60s things dealing with maybe the ambiguity of the time, where the idea was you're supposed to experience maybe the seamy side of life was the one interpretation, and the other was that experience only seems to be what it seems to be, right? So what kind of ambiguity was that? Was that structural or strictly lexical?
Well, I guess that'd be a part of speech one as well as a grammatical function, because seems as a noun or as a verb, and if it's a noun.
But when you read it, it's clear what it is. It's when it's spoken that it would be ambiguous, I guess, right?
Yeah. Let's see. If you read it, yeah, you're right. It's clear. You see the spelling spoken, not so much. And there are things that work the other way, too, where they might be ambiguous, not when spoken, but actually when written. One of my favorite examples of this is where we do have things that by our intonation are completely different once we hear them spoken than what they appear to be in writing. And I can't go into that particular example, but just to kind of summarize some things, there are identifiable things we can do with the language that follow patterns and that can be utilized effectively by advertisers and others.
Well, so we just have a minute or so left, Alan, and you have some formulas that you'll describe in your book and that you kind of alluded to at the beginning, you know, like the use of the word little and that kind of thing, that professional wordsmiths, if they get the hang of it, can use to help them generate the kind of things they do in their work. But how do you get people like that to read a book like yours? I don't think they're going to really read academic books on linguistics. How will you reach them, just very briefly?
Well, I think I probably have to just get the word out a little bit that this stuff is here. I probably would have to adjust the way I present some of the information so that it's more accessible. You know, I'm going from an academic book to maybe some other kind of eventual publication, but I would be interested to see some of the feedback or hear from others about whether they think some of this might be useful to them in their occupations.
Well, I guess that you're going to need a PowerPoint presentation, and you'll probably need a catchy slogan or product name yourself for this. Like, I was thinking maybe the jingle generator or the phrase maker or something. You'll have to have something that appeals to people who make phrases to sell it to them, right? But, well, it's been interesting, and I appreciate you being on with us, Professor Dallin Oaks, to talk about linguistics and structural ambiguity in English. And thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.